Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
In some ways, the presence of Amazon in the lives of Americans reminds me of the Fleetwood Mac song, Everywhere, because it's everywhere. 200 million people pay for Amazon Prime accounts to shop and stream content. 500 million Alexa devices sit in people's bedrooms, living rooms, and cars, gobbling up data about what we watch, what we listen to, and of course, what we buy. And AWS is the largest cloud computing company in the world. Buying Amazon is easy, convenient, and historically has been cheap. But there's a dark side to the Amazon story. The company has a history of competing with the very sellers whose brands it markets and has grown to dominate every industry it enters. The Amazon story raises profound questions about the appropriate role of antitrust enforcement, questions that may be answered in the sweeping antitrust case filed by the FTC. Wall Street reporter Dana Mattioli's deep dive into the Amazon story is set out in a pretty important new book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with some background. Can you start with a little bit about the original vision that Jeff Bezos had for Amazon? And what was the corporate culture like at the outset?
Yeah, so Amazon started in 1994 when very few Americans even had computers. And it was predicated on the idea that we'd all be shopping online, which sounded like a really far-fetched idea at the time, right? If only 23% of people even had a computer, 3% of people had ever been online. So it was this against all odds success story. And if you think about the early people who joined, they were largely idealists. They loved the idea that they could democratize reading and get books to far corners of the country or other countries where people didn't have bookstores nearby. They're really like this do-gooder population. And what happened was it obviously took off. Within weeks, people from every state in the country were ordering books from Amazon. And it didn't stop there. That was the canary in the coal mine. It started going into industry after industry. And the culture started to change around the time of the IPO. It had a lot of success, and the idealists started to leave, and the MBAs came in, and that's when you start seeing the culture change.
And so that as it changes, I guess one of the questions I really did not really focus on was the importance in the early days of Amazon, in particular, of its sales tax strategy. Can you explain that and why it was so significant?
Yeah, this is like one of their major advantages over the rest of retail. Amazon, for years, did not have to collect sales taxes in many of the states it operated in. They were able to exploit this loophole that around mail order catalogs, and that meant that Amazon could effectively charge less than their competitors on the same items, and it allowed them to steal share from the rest of the retail landscape. And between that and also this pass that they got from Wall Street where they didn't have to show profits but they were getting rewarded by shareholders, they were able to grow and reinvest in a way that their peers could not. And it started to cement this dominant lead in retail that just only grew as time went on.
Stay with that for a minute, because I found that really fascinating. Why was Amazon given a pass? I mean, normally, Wall Street, a publicly traded company, you're supposed to make a profit, and your share price is supposed to represent some multiple of that profit, at least in economic theory. Why was Amazon treated so differently?
So this was the advent of the dot-com movement, and software companies were going public, and they were able to start training investors that this is about growth, not profits, which is actually, exists today. There are a lot of unprofitable companies that are worth a lot on paper or in the stock market. But what was less common was for a retailer to be judged in that way. When I speak to, the CEOs of the other retailers at the time period that Amazon came online, they said that they would just get skewered by their investors had they missed even just one quarter on earnings, let alone years of no profits. And that meant that they couldn't spend the money to invest in their online e-commerce operations or their logistics because their investors would have killed them.
It's a completely different world. One of the things that Roger mentioned during the setup for the interview was how Amazon is the world's, or AWS is the largest cloud computing company in the world. Can you talk about how it became a dominant force in web services?
Yeah, so Amazon started getting so much business beyond books. You know, it really spread into every corner of retail. And it was getting so much volume of orders that it needed a lot of computing power to run this, and a lot of data and storage. And it was doing this all on the back end for its own business. And they realized, hey, we're actually really good at the infrastructure of the internet and compute and storage. Maybe we can make this into a service that other people also need. And that's the advent of Amazon Web Services, which is the biggest cloud computing company in the world, the most dominant, and even some of Amazon's fiercest rivals use Amazon Web Services, which says a lot.
And because it throws off obviously a fair amount of cash, I would assume, it sort of enables Amazon, it facilitates the ability of Amazon to subsidize other businesses to the extent it wants to, doesn't it?
That's correct. In the early days, that was like actually very important for the retail side of the business, where it is very slim margins, or they were undercutting prices to get market share. Today, it's actually pretty interesting. I think most people don't know how profitable retail is for Amazon, but it's a very profitable business we're able to expose in the book. But it does help them reinvest in things like devices, too.
And we're going to talk some more about the retail, because what you do in the book is absolutely fascinating. But before we get to specific, well, one of the things that comes in numerous times in the book is this concept of a flywheel. And you talk about a flywheel with respect to a number of aspects of Amazon's businesses. Can you sort of flesh that out with an example? I think one that I think would be interesting would be the context of either the Kindle or the Fire Stick.
Yeah, so if you think about Amazon, they are this giant octopus of a conglomerate with lots of different tentacles. And they look really disparate at first glance, but they're not. They all feed each other in some ways. So if you think about like the Fire Stick, for instance, which is a device they make to stream TV. If you buy a Fire Stick, right, you might start watching TV on it and you'll be served up ads. Amazon gets the revenue from the ads. You might also watch more Prime Video on it, which is an Amazon's, you know, entertainment offering, which means you will like your Prime subscription more and get more value from it. So you'll likely renew that at the end of the year. And if you renew it, that means you will start shopping more on Amazon as well, because you have this free 2-day shipping. So it's this self-reinforcing loop that you feed each part of that flywheel, and it just moves faster, and Amazon churns out more profits, more revenues, more data.
It's really interesting, because I think you talk about this in the book. There was a period of time when the concept of conglomerates was favored by Wall Street. You had companies like ITT that was owning things like NBC and Hostess Products, and then it fell into vast disfavor. But the Amazon conglomerate is different, because so many of the various industries feed each other in this flywheel, and it really is remarkable. I don't think there's anything else like it on the planet.
There's not, and it came in, they built their conglomerate at the very time that these structures went out of favor. The activist investor said, hey, this doesn't make sense, GE. Why do you own a hair curling iron maker and a turbine maker and microwaves? Like, do one thing, do it right, and spin off everything else. But for Amazon, the conglomerate is a bit of its secret sauce, because it means that they have more tentacles and more homes and more competitors. And when you think about the competitive landscape, they are market leaders in so many different industries that their competition often works with them on 1, 2, 3 of those tentacles, and it gives them all the leverage and so much data.
So can you discuss the relationship between Amazon and Sonos as an example of the way Amazon leverages its power?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a scene in the book that we get into how Amazon really helped revolutionize like voice-activated speakers with Alexa and their Echo devices. And they set up a business within Amazon called Alexa Voice Services that will help other device makers become Alexa enabled, so that you could speak to their speakers, right? And this creates a little bit of an uncomfortable situation for partners, because on the one hand, Alexa became so popular that they felt like they needed to enable their devices to have it. But on the other hand, Amazon's one of their fiercest competitors. So the whole idea of like co-opetition comes into play here. And so Sonos realizes that it does need to have a voice services offering, and it sends Amazon its prototypes for its nearest and most technological advances 6 months before it even hits shelves. And they and other companies that have gone through the Alexa voice services process feel like by partnering with Amazon and giving them that behind the scenes look and peek under the kimono, Amazon took some of their technology for their own products.
And again, one of the other themes in the book is the aggressiveness of the way Amazon sort of exploits its relationships. Another sort of example, and this was one where you had this scene where this company needs that access to the Alexa voicemail and allows you know, Amazon to look, as you say, look under the kimono. Amazon is supposed to have firewalls that restricts sort of one part of the business from another part of the business. But in the book, you sort of make it clear that it doesn't look like those firewalls are very strong. And another example of the kinds of things you see is the sort of the way it uses access to data to take advantage of competitors in the creation and marketing of Amazon Basics. Can you sort of explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so I get very deep into examples of how Amazon has this private label division where it makes its own products. And because it competes on the platform and owns it, there are some interesting scenarios that come up. And, you know, there's a very interesting culture at Amazon. It's very, very cutthroat. It's different than any other company I've covered in 18 years at the Wall Street Journal. And I would say that the pressure of the culture causes employees to do things that they know are unethical or maybe anti-competitive. And an example is with the private label group, they were under so much pressure to create home runs and hits for Amazon that they were accessing the data of the sellers on the site to reverse engineer their best products. So basically spying on third-party sellers on Amazon's website to create Amazon-branded products.
And you also talk about, and by the way, you mentioned the pressure on employees. We did a book a few months ago on Ray Dalio and sort of the way the employees at his hedge fund were subject to this thing called stacking, where, you know, mm-hmm. the bottom X percent get fired. That's also true at Amazon, isn't it?
That is true. They are one of the rare companies that still does stack ranking, where every year, no matter how the company performs, 6% of them are being cut. And these are, you know, obviously really brilliant people. So they're competing to keep their jobs with each other every day. And that leads to some consequences in terms of the behaviors that we see.
So another one that was really interesting, and there's a consistent pattern here, was the way you discussed the way Amazon approaches its sort of quasi-venture capital operation. Can you sort of talk about some of those examples where they would invite people in for a potential acquisition and what would happen?
Yeah, because Amazon is just so big in so many areas, from voice technology to cloud services to retail, you name it. If you're a company looking for an investment or an acquisition, you almost have to talk to them. And they have this Alexa Fund, which is a venture capital firm within Amazon. And it's kind of where things get muddy. If you're going up and down Sand Hill Road meeting with traditional VCs, you don't really have to worry about them stealing your idea. But because Amazon has so many different, basically, companies within the company, a pattern started to emerge. So these companies would meet with Amazon for a chance at funding and deal talks, and they'd essentially, over the course of months, give Amazon all of their information, their financials, their client reports, their engineering and technology roadmaps, really the most proprietary information you could share. And then Amazon or the Alexa Fund would engage for months. They'd bring the heads of businesses within Amazon to those meetings that stood to benefit from that information, like people like the heads of Alexa or the heads of AWS or other businesses at Amazon. And then months later, Amazon would ghost them, and then they'd launch a competing product. And we have so many examples of that in the book, and more than, frankly, I could fit in the book.
Now, I want to talk about the research the Journal did with respect to Roku. Can you tell us about Amazon's practices with respect to search functions?
Yeah, this gets into, again, Amazon owning the world's biggest online platform for e-commerce and then also competing on it. And what we found is that Amazon often gives itself a leg up on the website at the expense of third-party sellers or other sellers on the website. And with the example of Roku, for instance, Roku makes the leading competitor streaming device to Amazon's Fire TV product. And Amazon's also one of the biggest places for digital advertising. So it's really important that if you're a seller on Amazon, you have the ability to advertise because there's so many other sellers. So all of a sudden, Roku's ability to buy ads on Amazon.com gets taken away. And when you start doing searches for Rokus on Amazon.com, what comes up at the top? Amazon's Fire TV. And basically, this was an example of Amazon marking a competitor to themselves as, you know, not being able to advertise on their site in order to promote their own goods on top of it.
You know, this was just sort of one piece of there was a lot of information in the book. that sort of opened my eyes to the way in which those search functions work and how important they are. I mean, I think many of us just, you know, open Amazon, you type in a search, you think, okay, it's going to be somewhat random. It's going to sort of give me something close to what I want, and not focusing on just how complicated the sponsorships are and how much money is involved in sort of ranking the way in which they Amazon sort of points consumers to what, you know, they want them to do, which is what maximizes their revenue.
And that's all part of the flywheel. So the more people shop, the more sellers want to be on Amazon. And the more sellers there are, you need to differentiate yourself by buying the ads. That money goes back to Amazon, and round it goes in the flywheel, right? So it's this reinforcing loop.
Which really puts, you know, you know Amazon holds itself out. And you talk a little, in the latter part of the book, we get to some public policy stuff. And and we're going to get to Lena Khan because we couldn't have this conversation without it. But in the latter part of the book, you sort of talk about how Amazon touts what it does in terms of creating local employment. And can you probe a little bit into sort of how legitimate those claims are?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Amazon touts all the jobs it's created in ancillary markets and everything else. But, you know, there's also another side of this. First of all, a lot of the jobs it's created have been in the warehouses, and the warehouses have been a source of angst for the company because of the conditions for them. But you have to also think, you know, the last decade in retail, the storyline has been this retail apocalypse. There's been bankruptcies, job losses, and, you know, there were more department store jobs lost from 2001 to 2017, 18 times more than in coal mining, to just give you the state of retail right now. And it really depends on whose numbers you're looking at. You know, the Booksellers Association found that Amazon led to a net loss of 700,000 jobs in 2018. So there's not like a comprehensive study on Amazon's overall impact on job creation or losses because they're in so many industries, but you could see very markedly in retail that it has led to job losses.
And again, the book is filled with stories of independent sellers who get onto Amazon and how over time the company's various practices sort of eat into their margins to put them right at the edge of the ability to survive. Which sort of made me wonder, how long did it take you to do the research? There's a lot of data in this book.
Thank you. I reported this book over the course of 3 years. I had a baby in between, so it was like a very long process.
And I assume you, I have to ask, did you buy various baby products by shopping on Amazon?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
I was making a joke. I was asking if you shopped for baby products by shopping on Amazon because you were so time constrained. Because that's really the temptation, right? I mean, we look at Amazon and we think about our local merchants, we think about our Main Street, and we want to support them, but my goodness, it's awfully easy and convenient to just do a click.
Listen, they definitely make it easy, and I think it saved a lot of people during the pandemic, in particular when people didn't want to risk getting sick before the vaccine came out and going to their shops, right? So, I mean, there is that side of this as well.
You begin the book and you end the book by talking a little bit about someone who was then a Yale law student writing a law review article about traditional antitrust philosophy. Can you sort of, let's talk about what Lena Khan's article said and why it had such an impact.
Yeah, so in 2017, Lena Khan, who was just a law student at Yale, a relative unknown, writes this explosive law review article about Amazon being a monopoly, and she claims that the current antitrust laws are not being enforced in a way that is regulating the tech companies well. And remarkably, this goes viral. It has tons of readers in a way that law review articles typically do not. And people start piecing together the words Amazon and monopoly in the same sentence for the first time. You know, people had viewed the company as this darling that, to your point, has, you know, fast shipping, and people really like their Prime. And what she did is she said the last 40 years of antitrust history, where there was this reinterpretation of the laws, where, you know, big wasn't necessarily bad anymore, where there was more of a look at competition's impact on pricing and efficiencies, created these unintended consequences for Amazon and big tech, where these companies that either had low prices or had free products like a Facebook or a Google were able to grow unfettered. And that had other bad effects.
And, you know, she talks about the importance of, it was really interesting the way you covered it in the book, which is sort of covering how Kahn traced all this back to Robert Bork and the University of Chicago Economics School, and this notion that antitrust only acted to only ask the question, does it benefit the consumer? As opposed to all the other implications of competition. So you talk in the book about how concerned Amazon was during the with the advent of the Trump administration, as they had gambled all their government, you know, sort of relations functions on a Clinton victory. And then you talk about Amazon's concern with, lo and behold, who gets appointed as the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission but the very same Lina Khan.
Yeah, that's right. So she has this meteoric rise from 2017, just a student at law school, to the youngest chair in the FTC's 100-year history. And it's like then-President Biden had handpicked the person that Amazon would be most fearful of regulating them to head up the agency regulating them.
And what does she do?
So in September, in September of last year, she and the FTC filed a historic lawsuit against Amazon saying that they are a monopoly.
And so, and that lawsuit will take a while to play out. I assume you're going to get to cover that as it evolves, because I assume it's going to take a while.
It will take a while. It won't go to court till 2026.
Okay. All right. We've been speaking with Dana. Have I pronounced that right? Is it Mattioli?
That's right.
Okay, Dana Mattioli, about her fascinating new book, The Everything War: Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
A total of 323 drugs were in shortage in the first quarter of this year, according to data published this month by the American Society of Health System Pharmacists and the University of Utah Drug Information Service. That's the most medicine since the group began tracking shortages in 2001. For over two decades, the University of Utah's Drug Information Service has been methodically investigating and logging prescription drug shortages, providing a nationwide database that has become indispensable for hospitals, think tanks, and lawmakers. Aaron Fox leads the University of Utah Drug Information Service, which provides content for the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. She is a board-certified pharmacist and senior pharmacy director at the University of Utah Health and professor at the University of Utah College of Pharmacy. Aaron joins us this morning to update us on the latest drug shortage data. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Let's begin. Can you give our listeners a bit of information about the Drug Information Service, and how did it begin?
Sure. So our Drug Information Service has been around for over 50 years, but our project around drug shortages began in 2000, and we noticed a lot of national drug shortages. We had a great system for tracking shortages at our own health system. And so what we did was decided to kind of share the wealth so that other hospitals wouldn't have to recreate the wheel. And that's how we started following national drug shortages.
And with that, as you mentioned, you were tracking it yourself to be able to kind of find that data. Who uses your data that you track?
You know, our audience is really clinicians. So our audience, we're aiming for pharmacists, nurses, providers, doctors, folks that are trying to take care of a patient. But lots of people use the information. It's a public website, so anyone can actually go on and find the information. But the type of information that we're targeting really is for healthcare providers.
So I'm visualizing just how complicated it would be to gather all this information. Who do you query? Where do you get your data, and how do you get your data?
That's such a good question. You know, we report our own shortages, so we're not immune from our own shortages, but we get reports nationally from all kinds of different reporters. And what we do is so when I say reporter, I mean, you know, a health system or a pharmacist who can't access a medicine. So what we do then is we gather up all the information, all the different suppliers, all the different formulations, and then we start contacting the companies directly to see if it's truly a problem or if it's just kind of a small glitch in the supply chain.
And what typically causes drug shortages?
So that's another such a good question. You know, most of the time, we don't know the true answer for why a shortage is happening. And part of that is because companies are allowed to keep that a secret. The FDA does post reasons on their shortage website, but sometimes those reasons are other, which to me is unknown. And then the good thing, though, is FDA does publish information about drug shortages in aggregate. So while, you know, again, some companies do want to keep the exact reason why there's a shortage a secret, you can get the information that from the aggregate data the FDA provides. Most of the time it's a quality problem at the manufacturing facility. And, you know, whether that's old machinery breaking down or some kind of a sterility problem where there's mold growing, different things like that can cause quality problems.
How often is a shortage due to production limits on controlled substances?
That is such a good question. You know, we saw earlier this year, actually late last year, both FDA and the DEA kind of pointing the fingers at drug companies, and then the drug companies pointing the fingers back, saying we can't make enough ADHD medicines because we don't have enough of the quota from the DEA. But then we also had the DEA saying, look, companies, you haven't used all of the amount that we gave you. Because, again, there's this lack of transparency, what we don't have is the ability to check exactly how much each company has produced, how much they've sold, and kind of align that with the amount that the DEA gave them to make. We can't do that calculation. So it turns into a lot of finger pointing. We know that we are seeing more shortages from companies saying that they are going to have problems with making things like morphine and hydromorphone injections that hospitals use, and they're directly blaming the change in the way that DEA is controlling the quota that they hand out to the companies to make those medications.
How much of the prescription drug universe in this country, and particularly on the generic side, is produced overseas, and to what extent are, you know, sort of international supply chain issues driving some of these shortages?
Sure. So there are actually bipartisan legislation in both the House and the Senate to try to map out exactly where our supply chain is most vulnerable. You know, which products are only made in maybe one country, rely on maybe one source of a raw material, because all of that is actually unknown. We know that a large amount of the raw materials come from overseas, but if you purchase a medication and you look at the information about it, a lot of times it will just say manufactured for, and then the company's name that is selling it to you, instead of, you know, some more detailed information like we're used to seeing, say, around our food or even clothing or you know, a computer that we buy, where it could say, you know, manufactured by, and it lists a specific company. It might list the specific site of location as well as the company selling it. With medications, the required labeling laws really allow a lot of that to be kept a secret.
Boy, that's really fascinating. In other words, what you're telling me is that I can get more information, that Hershey is required to provide far more information on Mr. Goodbar than when I go to the pharmacy and pick up something that I'm going to be taking every day.
It's wild. You know, I also think about, you know, when you buy some lettuce, right? Sometimes you can even see the farm that grew the lettuce, not so with medications.
And do you think that is related to the historical power of the pharmaceutical industry in terms of lobbying? Do you think that's why they've escaped these kinds of labeling requirements? Obviously, there's major labeling requirements with respect to what you can do with it, right? There are, you know, the required labels for usage. It's this idea that there's not required labeling for manufacturing ingredients. It seems to me to be really a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah, it is. It is strange. And I think, you know, it's just something that has existed for a long time. And people didn't really actually care too much about it until we started seeing so many supply chain problems and some quality problems. So, yeah, I mean, honestly, would I care, you know, where a specific medication came from? Maybe not necessarily, but I do these days, because we're trying so hard to track down and figure out the supply chain problems, as well as we have seen, you know, recalls and other quality issues. So I think that's where that kind of level of transparency would be helpful, and that's something that Congress can change.
And that's what I find kind of interesting about this topic. It seems like, well, you know, you were following the drug shortage for yourself, but then realized it could help others, you know, and the whole mapping of where things are coming from. It's again, just starting to morph into this need. Let's talk about what came about last week. CNBC last week published that drug shortages are at a new high. Can you talk to us about what drugs are currently in shortage, even though I do realize there's like 323 on the list?
Sure. You know, there are some pretty broad categories. So we have some antibiotics that are short, things like, you know, the pink amoxicillin liquid that you might get if your child has an ear infection. There are things that hospitals mostly use, things like, you know, concentrated morphine injections and fentanyl injections, things that are really only used during surgery. We also have shortages of some basic products that are used throughout healthcare. You know, think about a lidocaine injection. If you cut yourself and need to go get stitches, you know, they might use that in a clinic. It's also used, you know, for major surgeries and inside hospitals as well. So the key thing about all of these products that are short is that most of them are injectables. Most of them have been around for a long time, so they're generic. We also do see some oral products that are short, so things like the ADHD medications, those are also short. And I think, you know, the total number is frustrating. And I would say that it's not necessarily any shortage has gotten worse. We just keep adding more to the list without shortages resolving. And I think, you know, many of these shortages are taking years and years to resolve. I think we're almost at 10 years with that local, you know, lidocaine injection shortage lasting for a really long time. And so when you have shortages kind of adding on top of each other, that's really how we've gotten to this high number.
With regards to the lidocaine shortage, you mentioned it's generic. You know, it's been on the market for a really long time. Is any of this due to the fact that, like, the profit margins are not as high on those? Why is that they're not getting produced to the level they are needed?
Yeah, I mean, that is the short answer. You know, there's really not a lot of profitability in these products. And so, you know, when there's a quality problem, when there's a supply glitch, the companies that make these products actually don't suffer economically. That, you know, they're not really making a lot of profit anyway. But, you know, disproportionately, you know, patients in hospitals suffer by not having the medications that they need in the right strengths and the right sizes. And so, you know, part of this is definitely an economics issue where you're selling products for such a low price that it's, you know, companies don't really even want to make some of these products anymore.
And of course, this is part of the complex economics of the healthcare industry because, you know, the old Econ 101 answer to that would be, well, wait a minute. If the problem is that they're not priced high enough to make them profitable, why wouldn't the prices go up? And I guess that's part of the complexity of how drugs are compensated in this country.
That's right. You know, when you think about hospitals receiving mostly bundled payments, hospitals have a lot of incentives to only use the very, very lowest cost products. And hospitals band together to use their bargaining power through group purchasing organizations to try to, you know, get good contracts and, you know, just the lowest prices possible. So that those incentives are a little bit misaligned mm-hmm. when the prices get driven really to the bottom. But I think the other part to think about this is we also have newer legislation that was just passed to kind of punish companies from raising prices too high. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, certainly we do have very, very high drug prices in the U.S., but when we think about some of these very old generics, it may not make sense to apply that same rule to these lower cost products that really might need to raise their prices to get to a sustainable price. Mm.
You had jumped in and mentioned a little bit about GPOs, the group purchasing organizations. Can you explain a little bit more what they are? And then as well, I noticed that one of them is a partner in the Drug Information Service.
Oh yeah, no. So just to clarify, so Vizient is actually not a partner in our drug information service at all. But our hospital is a member of Vizient. They are a group purchasing organization. And group purchasing organizations, really most hospitals belong to one of these. What they do is they really allow you to have access to a large number of contracts. You can kind of think about it almost as a little bit like a Costco model, where you would have access to some drugs with really good pricing, and you know, these group purchasing organizations also bargain for other things hospitals need, food contracts. you know, socks, gowns, you know, all kinds of things that hospitals need. So it's absolutely not just drugs. You can choose to buy from those contracts or not, but because there are so many hospitals banding together, they are trying to bargain for good pricing, again, because of that incentive of how hospitals get paid by those bundled payments. So, yeah.
And do you only belong to one? I mean, you mentioned Costco. I mean, in the consumer world, you could choose to belong to both Sam's and Costco, I suppose. Do GPOs work that way as well? Or does Utah, for example, only belong to one?
You know, University of Utah is just part of Vizient, but mm-hmm. you could be part of multiple if you wanted to.
And again, how... If the GPOs are there to sort of serve the interests of their hospital constituents, have they started to put pressure on these manufacturers to increase supply? Or, again, is their whole mindset one of driving costs down?
You know, I think, you know, because the GPOs are basically doing what the hospitals ask them to do. So certainly cost is a factor, but I think the other thing to keep in mind is a lot of these GPOs are actually working on strategies to improve drug supplies. So whether that's maintaining longer contracts with specific drug companies, asking for, you know, assured supplies for hospitals. There's actually a lot of work going on to try to help with shortages from all kinds of different GPOs.
So as you're tracking drug shortages, are you tracking, or is there another organization tracking the patients that are impacted? Is there data showing kind of what this shortage does?
That is a really big gap in information that we have. We don't have, a national healthcare system to know, you know, exactly how many patients are impacted by a shortage and what those outcomes are. We do see clinical papers published. We know that, you know, in past shortages, during chemotherapy shortages, you know, some patients did not have as good of outcomes. We know during shortages of critical care medications, things like norepinephrine, when that is short, we also know that those patients also don't have as good of outcomes. But in general, there's not a standard tracking for patient outcomes and impact from the shortages. And I would say that in most cases, hospitals are doing and pharmacies are doing everything they can to mitigate the impact to patients. It takes a lot of work and labor costs for the hospitals to do that. And I think at the end of the day, right now, hospitals are already paying more for these products just because of all the work they're doing to manage the shortages. So I think, you know, a way forward would be to pay a little bit more for these generic products and have access to them instead of doing all these workarounds to manage the shortage.
You made reference to the fact that many hospitals get paid. For example, I know in Medicare, for example, an inpatient stay is done on a DRG, which is sort of a fixed price. So other kinds of stays are not done that way. And, you know, you'll see, you know, detailed charge sheets that reflect, you know, what a patient stay costs. Are there circumstances where hospitals, because they can pass through a cost, are able to pay more and buy their way around shortages with respect to particular patients?
You know, not really. And, okay. And the reason for that is when you have a pretty severe shortage, there really isn't that kind of
black market
where you can buy it for
can't go down, you know, to the corner and
buy a higher price. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, Aaron, you serve as the media resource and advocate for changes. And you advocate for changes to improve the ongoing drug shortage situation and rising drug costs. What solutions are you advocating for to help this situation?
So one of the ways that we've gotten into this is with these generic products, FDA says they're all equal, and that's really how we've structured the generic drug program in the United States. But there really are some pretty clear differences in companies that are doing a better job than others, but we need that transparency, right? We need to know who's making those drugs, who's doing that better job. And so, you know, over the years, even FDA has advocated for a rating system that is different than kind of this pass-fail on-the-market, off-the-market that we have. So we need that transparency to create a different rating system so that these generic products can compete on something besides price. Because right now we just have had a race to the bottom on pricing, and in order to kind of fix that, we do need to, you know, choose to purchase from companies that are investing in their supply chains. But the only way to get there is that transparency.
And, you know, again, you had mentioned that, you know, we don't have a national healthcare system. Are there other solutions in other countries that you've seen that might address this as well?
You know, we do see shortages in other countries, so it's okay. Not just a U.S. System, a U.S. problem. And I think part of that is because drug manufacturing is very global. There are manufacturing plants all over the world. Things get very intertwined, and I think we saw that also with COVID. But, you know, I think the national systems do a better job of tracking the impact on their population and patients, just because they have that national system of data. Some of these countries can also do a better job of making things more fair when you do have to ration medications. You can quickly have a standard for, okay, this medication is short, so we're only going to use it for these very specific patients who could benefit the most. That's done very piecemeal right now in the U.S., hospital by hospital.
No, that makes sense. Well, we've been speaking with Erin Fox. She leads the University of Utah Drug Information Service. Erin, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Park City's Women Inspired Network is hosting an event this month. Reduce stress, build strength, find calm, cultivate more joy. The event's going to be held at Park City Yoga Institute, and the event is on April 27th. It's also a fundraiser for the organization's Win for Good Scholarship Fund. Joining us this morning to talk more about this is Casey Ring with Win and Melissa Garland with the Yoga Mastery Institute. Ladies, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And Casey, I just turned on your mic, so sorry about
great.
That.
Thank you so much
it's
for having us.
It's important for women to have a voice.
I'm working on it. So, Casey, let's begin. What is the Park City Women's Inspired Network?
Sure. So, WIN, Park City, or the Women's Inspired Network, is a group of local women of all ages, all backgrounds. We get together once a month. On Tuesday evenings, the first Tuesday, and it's really about supporting each other, helping each other grow personally and professionally. And we have about 75 members currently. We had a little break during COVID, of course, so we're growing and coming back. But our main mission beyond getting together as women and helping to support each other in the community is we add to a scholarship fund every year, and we finally got our 501c3, which is awesome. So we give scholarships to local women at all four of the area high schools. So that's coming up in May. We give out our scholarships, and this fundraiser is to fill up our scholarship fund also.
You know, it's really interesting. You hear about business networks, and so often they are just about business. And what's interesting about this group, what I'm hearing from you, is how far more holistic it is in terms of what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. You know, it's very important for all of us to give to each other, but also to give back to the community. And we really strive to help local young ladies who want to pursue their education and may not have the full means to do so. So we work with all the local area high schools. We accept applications. We review the applications. And, you know, our goal is to make this a really significant scholarship fund and really beef up that 501c3 so that we can help local women to further their education.
Now, scholarships are going to be handed out in May. So this April, the event on the 27th is all about raising money. Yeah. Do you have a goal of either how much you'd like to raise or how many scholarships you're hoping to give?
Yes. So Melissa so kindly put this program together for us, and all the proceeds that we make are going to those scholarships. I think we have room for 80 attendees at this event.
Wow.
And so our goal is to raise $4,000 for our scholarship kitty. And, you know, we have been kind of giving $500 increments on scholarships. And we're trying to hear back from our connections at the high schools. Is it better to do many smaller scholarships, or is it better to really, you know, give a big chunk of money to fewer students? So in the past, we've always done around that $500 range, but we may change that in the future based on need and what helps the students the best.
Now, you mentioned that there was room for 80. Melissa, tell us a little bit about the event and what those 80 people will be able to do.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to share what we're up to. Yoga Mastery Institute is the evolution of a business that many people know in Park City as Tadasana Yoga. We were a fitness business for 20 years here, offering a variety of yoga styles, and in the past year have made a pretty radical shift to a focus on mental wellness, which comes through the combination of physical movement, meditation, and mindfulness discussions. And so this program that we're offering for the WIN Network is essentially a taste of what it's all about. It's an opportunity to come and learn how to do five core yoga poses, how to begin to create a meditation practice, and how to start thinking a bit about how to handle your emotions as they arise, and all of the combination of these things that in the program that we're offering is starting to have some really amazing impact on people's stress and anxiety levels, which is our ultimate goal, which is to help people see a significant reduction in stress and anxiety.
So the WIN event coming up on the 27th, this is obviously an opportunity for people to check out the Yoga Mastery Institute. How long is the time that they'll be working through your program that evening?
That evening. We're doing a 90-minute session that evening, and which is the perfect time because people get some customized attention to how lots of people who practice, even if you practice for a long time yoga, but lots of people have not and are really interested in really understanding how to do things. So we have some time to dig into that, which is what we find that people really enjoy a lot about it. So we'd love to have people come along and really not only support WIN, which is the big, big goal, but also to do something for themselves.
Yes, and just a minor correction. It's in the morning.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. It's at 10 a.m. to noon on Saturday.
Thank you.
So it's a great way to get your Saturday going with some, you know, great movement and mindfulness and mm-hmm. learn a little bit about what Melissa's team has to offer here locally and fill up some scholarships.
And then I also assume that there's going to be some networking time as well that morning?
Yeah, a little bit. I think afterwards, of course, you know, we'll go through the program and go through the session and we'll have an opportunity to ask Melissa's team questions, learn more about their offering, but then also talk about WIN and how to get involved and how to be involved in the scholarship donations and all of that. So,
and talk a little bit more about the fundraising aspects. Is there a minimum price for the event, and will there be other fundraising activities going on surrounding the event?
Thank you so much. It will be a $50 tax-deductible donation to our 501c3. And we plan to do these on a quarterly basis, you know, trying to envelop the business community, women-owned businesses, and have some fun doing some different activities on a quarterly basis specifically to raise money for our scholarships.
So raising money quarterly, but yet I do believe you meet monthly, and
we do. Those are
always at a different location, that's correct?
That's true, same. We try to go to different businesses throughout the community, not only in Park City, but we try to visit businesses in Wasatch County. We have plans to have meetings over in Camas soon. And so membership dues, we do also little, raffles at each meeting, so people can raffle off items and products from here locally, and sponsorships. All of those ways are how we are able to donate the scholarships, and we're a 100% volunteer organization, so all the money that we raise goes to the scholarships.
Melissa, can you let listeners know where you're located as they're looking to join the event on the 27th?
Yeah, absolutely. We are out at Quarry Village, so the Pinebrook Jeremy Ranch exit on the Pinebrook side of the highway. We face the highway. If you've never been over there, where it first turn in as you get off the highway and go around that roundabout.
And then, Casey, just going back, you meet on the first Tuesdays of the month. The 27th is a Saturday, so you must have a meeting coming up pretty quick as
well. We do. May 7th, I think, is the first Tuesday in May. And so we will be meeting at Fulfilled in the Outlet Mall. And, yeah, the best way to see what we're doing is winparkcity.com. So winparkcity.com.
And continuing again, as you mentioned, scholarship opportunities. Let's say someone is unable to attend the event on Saturday. Can they still make a donation towards
absolutely.
The scholarship fund?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Where they can they find out that information?
So we have an events tab on our website, the winparkcity.com, and you can go right in there and make your donations as well.
That's great. And then again, this is really for anyone, yes?
Yes. Anyone in the community who really is not only looking to support our cause, but, you know, you want to start your Saturday morning off with learning some mindfulness techniques and meditation and movement and learn a little bit about what Melissa's team has to offer. It's for you. And, you know, all ages, all sizes, all groups, come and visit us.
Yeah, we're seeing some really exciting responses to what we're doing from men who've always said they wanted to get into yoga but didn't feel comfortable in some of those yoga classes, right? Not really sure what to do. People who have specific injuries, challenges, they aren't really sure how to modify what they're doing. This is a big part of what they'll get exposure to in our program. So even if you're, you know, coming just for yourself and want to also support, that this is a great opportunity for people to do two things at once, and they can learn more about the program on our website as well, yogamasteryinstitute.com.
Sounds great. Well, we've been speaking with Casey Ring as well as Melissa Garland about the Win for Good Scholarship Fund event coming up on Saturday. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. If you like Mountain Money, let us know. Please leave a review.